Coming up next on This Week in Computer Hardware, the BMW of gaming mice. One amazing AMD 7970, less expensive MOBO, Steam's big picture, Hackintosh success, and good news, AMD and Intel claim your sockets are safe. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, recorded December 6th, 2012. Good news, Intel's not killing the desktop.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Lantronics, maker of the XPrint server. Print from your iPad, iPhone, or any iOS device to virtually any printer. For more information, visit xprintserver.com/twit and enter coupon code HOLIDAY2012 to receive 20% off your order.
Evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm your host, Patrick Norton, and this is the show on the Twit Network where we talk to you about, well, computer hardware. There's a big shock. We talk about tablets. We talk about graphics cards. We talk about CPUs. We try to make sure you get the most out of what you want to buy, whether you're looking for low-end parts or high-end parts. I shouldn't say low-end, but you know what I mean? If you're on a budget, we can help you. If you want to spend all the money, Ryan can really help you. Ryan Shrout, ladies and gentlemen, PCPer.com. We'll talk about it in a second, but I believe you have in your hands or on your desktop right now one of the most expensive GPUs money can buy or will be able to buy when it goes on sale. How's it going, man?
It's close. It's good. It's going well. It's that time of the year where I start to look at my watch and I go, it's December 6th and Christmas is almost here. We were talking about Amazon orders, and I was like, oh, I haven't started any of that stuff yet. Plus, there's this whole CES thing coming up, and there's a lot going on. It's a very busy time, but
we were actually
never bored.
We should explain to the audience, anybody who was not listening to the show live, in pre-show, Ryan was discussing his Amazon addiction, his Amazon Prime addiction, and that he had 59 orders in 2011, and he was at 51 with, you know, what, 26 days, 27 days left, or 25 days, math is hard for English majors, left in 2012. I think he should try to get to 70 orders, really set a new record. Just go all Babe Ruth on that mother. And I think you can do it, man, especially since you pointed out you like to order things like dog food on Amazon.
Well, see, like here, I ordered two bags of dog food on the same order. What I should have done was make one order and then make another order, right? If I really want to, if my goal is just order count, let's cheat the system and go with what we can.
You know,
anyway,
you
let's actually, move on.
You don't want to talk about hardware. Automated diaper deliveries. Okay. What's as exciting as automated baby wipe deliveries are, and let me tell you something, they are exciting if you're a parent. Mice, the great unsung heroes of the desktop. Gaming mice are actually really funny, right? If you've never actually had your hands on a gaming mouse, one of two things are going to happen. You're A, going to look at it and think to yourself, that looks incredibly uncomfortable. Or B, you're going to wrap your mitts around it. You're going to think, yes, this is what I need to crush, maim, and destroy in my very, very first-person shooter. TT Esports Level 10 M adjustable gaming mouse. Ryan Shrout has been hands-on and says, I quote, thermal take brings BMW to the mouse. What makes this that much better than any other oddly shaped mouse with too many buttons and adjustable weights? Tell me, Mr. Shrout.
So I don't really think
3D steering.
3D steering. 3D steering is, so you have this mouse and it has two adjustable wrenches on it. Okay. Two adjustable areas. And you can raise the body of the mouse up or lower it a little bit so you can kind of change the camber of your hand a little. And then if you look at it on this side, this actually kind of twists back and forth this way, and you can adjust within 5 degrees either direction on what that is as well. This particular gaming mouse, it's expensive. And a lot of it is because of that. When I said Thermaltake brings BMW to the mouse, I really mean that quite literally. Not that it's a super high-end product, which it is, but it's a BMW-inspired design. Like the BMW group that did the Level 10 case through Thermaltake also was responsible, at least partly, for the mouse. It's expensive, like a BMW. It's $95. I wish BMWs were $95. But it has some interesting things. It has some programmable buttons, but it doesn't have a ton of them, like maybe the M90, I think it is, from Corsair. But it has some programmable macro buttons. It stores those macros in the mouse, so you don't have to have the software on the computer that you take it to, right? You can take this to your buddy's house. You can go to a LAN party and hook your mouse up to somebody else's computer, and your profiles and settings will already be configured and ready to use and that kind of stuff. It has, they call it air through ventilation, which is this set of holes, honeycomb looking.
The anti-palm sweat technology.
Right. An attempt to. I think Thermaltake a long time ago, I think it was Thermaltake, made a mouse that had like a fan in it that would kind of blow across it. But, fans and fingertips, not a good idea, generally, spinning fan blades. So the idea here is they call it air through ventilation. So it's supposed to be just like a passive thing. I don't really know if it does that much. The 3D steering, as I already explained, it has LED lighting. You can RGB. You can control that in software and set those to your liking. It has a laser sensor that goes up to 8,300 DPI. And I forget
what the polling rate is. That's pretty impressive, actually.
Yeah, it's like, it's too fast, though. For me, I tend to like lower DPI mice and have a larger desk space for what I want to do, as opposed to having small desk space and high DPI stuff. So I mean, it's an interesting mouse. It's cool. You can adjust the DPI settings on the fly. You can adjust which profile you're using on the fly. So if you're going into, you're going to go load up Far Cry 3 or Battlefield 3 or something like that, mm-hmm. you just hit one of these. You hit this 5-way button, and you can switch between your profiles and that kind of stuff. And you can go from 3D rendering mode to 3D gaming mode and that kind of stuff, if that's what you want to do. It's a nice product. It really is. It's really hard to recommend a $95 mouse to somebody.
Well, I mean, you're not going to pick up this. Very few people in the Twitch audience are going to pick up this mouse and go from frag bait to gods of insert name of your favorite first person shooter here. However, if you appreciate a nice mouse, this is an aesthetic decision, because you look at this and it's got this, actually, I kind of like the way it's a big flat sheet of like 7-gauge aluminum that's been bent over. It's got the way the cables are hung. This is a mouse that is about aesthetics as much as it is about performance.
Yeah, that's correct. Just like the level 10 case was when it was first released, right? Yeah, exactly.
So I got to ask it. This is a question we never ask more than once or twice a week. Is this the fastest GPU ever? The Asus Matrix Radeon HD 7970 3-gigabyte overclocked graphics card.
So this is the 7970 Matrix here, and right. I think this is still a single GPU card, as big as it is, and it's a 3-slot. Yeah, this is still just a single GPU card. It's a single HD 7970. But they've done some interesting stuff to it.
Is this one of the fastest GPUs available in the market today? But not the fastest, because it has a single GPU. Sorry.
It's still one of the fastest single GPU cards you can buy. Maybe not out of the box necessarily, because here's what's interesting. This particular card, this Matrix card, is incredibly over-engineered. It's good for overclocking, great for LN2 overclocking. It's good for those types of use cases. So there's all kinds of headroom in here. The clocks out of the box are not that super impressive. It runs at 1.1 gigahertz, which is just 100 megahertz over what the standard 7970 gigahertz editions cards will ship at, obviously. But what this card does have is it has things like a 50 or a 56 larger power plane, right? So it spreads the power delivery subsystem over a 56% larger area than the reference card, which allows you to have lower voltage drop and that kind of stuff. So if you're doing overclocking, and I'm not just talking about LN2 overclocking, even if you're doing standard overclocking, you're going to see advantages out of that. It has a very, very efficient cooler on it. There's two fans on here. They're actually independent. They can be independently controlled. They're 100 millimeter fans. The heatsink on here is all copper heat pipes with aluminum fins on it. It runs 10 degrees Celsius cooler than the reference card, and it runs I think 9 or 10 decibels lower sound levels than the reference card as well. So 10 dBA is a huge difference in sound level. Yeah. And we were able to, I was able to overclock this particular card to 1300 megahertz on the GPU, which is really, really impressive, actually. And it was the fastest single GPU card that we had tested at that point. Plus, it has stuff like, if you look at the external connections, you've got 2 DVI and 4 full-size DisplayPort connections as well, which means you can run 6 monitors off of this card, which is good, right? So this is, remember when we had those cards that were called iFinity 6? This kind of wraps up all these types of features, but it's 3 slots. It's big, too. I mean, look at how high the PCB goes over this riser card, right? So it's definitely a beast, and it's $499. It's expensive, but considering your reference 7970 gigahertz edition cards go for $449, it's actually not that big of a penalty or upcharge to go from just your standard basic reference design to this ASUS Matrix card, which if you can find it in stock, then that makes a lot of sense because I do think you're going to get more overclocking headroom out of it than you would, you know, a normal reference card from any vendor, including ASUS.
Yeah, the power plant on the card is like fascinating to look at. It's just very beautifully designed. It also seems to be very, very overbuilt.
Yeah, I mean, and this card is meant for people that want to do LN2 overclocking. Some of the features on it, like if we look at the back here, it'd probably be better to look at the pictures in the article, but there are buttons, plus and minus buttons on the back, just physical buttons on the card that you push to increase the voltages. There's a safe mode button that you push when you overclock too far. You shut down the machine, you push that button and reboot, and it reverts back, like kind of like a clear CMOS. There's a 100% fan button that when you feel like you're maybe a little bit on the unstable side, you push that button, fans immediately go to 100% and try to cool everything down. But that's only useful, obviously, if you're using an open test bed, which really usually means you're doing some kind of competitive overclocking or professional overclocking or whatever you want to call it, right? So what I was afraid of was when I got this is that these features that, you know, I don't do LN2 overclocking, were going to be too far over my head and put the price of this card outside of the realm of where I think normal people might want to go. And it's really not the case. $50 is not, you know, something to sneeze at necessarily. But if you're already buying a $449 card and you're buying it because this is the top end AMD card, this maybe is the new top end AMD card for that.
It just looks like it's very well engineered. It's very much over engineered, like you pointed out. The load indicator, does that actually work? And is that looking at the heat coming off of it, or the amount of computing it's actually doing?
It's actually looking at the compute, the load of the GPU. So it scales from, you know, green all the way up to red, and that, you know, depending on what the load level is. And while you're playing Battlefield 3, when you see the frame rate, you know, kind of crunch down, you'll see the light go up a little bit more full red, you know, and a little bit away from the purple and that kind of stuff. So it's not really useful, again, unless you either have if you have an open test bed, or if you have a window and it's just cool to look at.
No, it's totally useful, because if you think your card is slowing down, if you see extreme loading, you know it's time to go crossfire and get a second card.
There you go. And maybe that's why they do that. This whole time, I didn't even think about that.
We've been waiting with bated breath for the Microsoft Surface Pro. And Scott over at PCPro.com has the write-up, Microsoft Surface Pro priced and dated. So Surface RT, of course, is the Surface that's out now. It's the ARM-based version of the new tablet from Microsoft. Big step from Microsoft delivering computing hardware, even if it is a tablet. A lot of their traditional partners kind of looked over and went, excuse me, what are you doing in Redmond? You're building hardware that competes with what I build? Thanks, delete expletive. So Surface RT, $499 for the ARM-based device. That, of course, means it will run apps off of the Windows Store and nowhere else. The Windows Surface Pro, there's going to be 2 SKUs, 4 to 64 gigabyte version for $899. Or $1,000, excuse me, $999 for 120 gigabytes of flash storage. What's nice about that is you're looking at an Intel i5 processor, 4 gigs of RAM, and an Intel HD 4000 GPU, 10.6-inch 1080p display, which is pretty standard. And it was interesting. On TechZilla, we had a funny question where somebody was looking at the Asus tablets, their Asus 10-inch tablets, and they're like, is this going to be powerful enough? And it's like, well, is, you know, an Android tablet or is an iOS tablet going to be powerful enough? Because essentially in that case, what you were looking at is the Atom, which, while a fantastic system on a chip and dual core and to a degree hyper-threaded, is still nothing particularly powerful compared to a Core i5 or even a Core i3, I think. So this is not going to be this is essentially a full-scale laptop with a relatively low resolution screen compared to some of the ones we've seen coming out in the last year or two. But, you know, a medium-priced $1,000 laptop, and I would highly recommend if you're buying one of these, spend the extra $100 and get the 128 gigabytes of flash storage.
Yeah. For sure. So,
and neither one of them are going to include the keyboard cover in the price. So I can only imagine what the cost on that fantabulous piece of hardware is going to be. But yeah, this will be the premier experience for Windows 8, ladies and gentlemen. The one thing I haven't figured out is, can you put more memory in that? Because that's what kills me about the Atom CPUs. They are capped at 2 gigabytes of RAM, and that kills me.
Well, this, I mean, this is Core i5. So will you be able to add it yourself, though? Don't think so.
Mini display port. I just went to the TechNet blog that was linked to. The mini display port can drive an external display up to 2560 by 1440 resolution. Pen input.
It's essentially ultrabook hardware. It's an ultrabook. Right. In a tablet, as opposed to an ultrabook and a laptop, right? So it's basically the exact same hardware that you would get in an ultrabook, which kind of explains the pricing. it's almost justifiably priced. You know, people were concerned about the fact that the battery life was announced to be half of the Surface RT, but that would put it at about 4 hours, which is about where every ultrabook today currently stands. I don't think anybody was expecting a miracle out of this. You know, using the exact same hardware, suddenly you get rid of the keyboard and you get more battery life. That's not an answer. So I think the Surface Pro is the word I used to describe my feelings when I heard more about it was underwhelming. You know, it's just I wanted it to be something really exciting. You know, like the Surface RT is a great device. It has a lot of software issues that I'm trying to deal with. That the Surface Pro wouldn't have the software issues, but if it has, you know, battery life and power and heat issues, then
14 millimeters thin with the additional Super Slice 4000, you'll get 12 hours of battery life. Yeah, it's kind of funny because it's thin, it's light, it's aesthetically, it's very compelling. Mm-hmm. I got to say, Windows 8 runs with 4 gigabytes of RAM considerably better than Windows 7. I actually have a Core i5 with 4 gigabytes of RAM. I had originally built a server to do some light rendering, and I've been using it as a desktop. And I've been under Windows 7. I was dying to get more memory inside that box. And with Windows 8, I no longer have that desperate feeling that I need more RAM because the way the memory handling works inside of it. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see whether or not anybody buys the Surface Pro and how the sales numbers are on the Surface RT.
Agreed.
Steam officially releases Big Picture Mode. What is this?
So this is Big Picture Mode is basically a Steam client interface for a PC that is meant for like the 10-foot distance, right? So for you sitting on a couch and the Steam client being on the TV, if you've ever tried that, you know, looking at small lines of text and trying to go through the Steam interface was kind of painful. So now with the Big Picture Mode, as they call it, it introduces bigger pictures of everything, right? So you can access the store, you can access your games in a controller-friendly, couch distance friendly interface. And it's been kind of in beta for a while. You could go into the options and enable it and that kind of stuff. But the newest release of the Steam regular client actually has like a big button right in the top right hand side of it that says Big Picture Mode. They're definitely trying to get people to touch it, push it, and see what happens. And even if you're on your PC, you can still play around with it and use your, you know, mouse and keyboard to navigate through it. Not the best for that, but it looks like maybe the interface you would see on an Xbox 360 or PS3 or something like that, right? It's meant to, I think, help bring the idea of PC gaming into more places than just your desk on in front of your monitor, right? And so they're running a big sale on all these controller-friendly PC games, which is, in my opinion, almost all of them will work with, like, if you have a USB Xbox 360 controller, they work really well. And I'm really excited about this because I have right now my home theater PC, quote, you know, TV gaming PC is just a laptop with an HDMI connection that I run out, you know, and the benefit is I can take it with me. I come home, plug in the HDMI cable, boom, you're done. You're ready to go. But now you can start up the big picture mode and I don't have to worry about, you know, how do I have to squint to see the game listings. You know, you can do the chat and all, you can navigate through the chat, through your friends list and all that kind of stuff in this big picture mode as well. So they basically just, it's a new interface for the most popular PC gaming application out there. And I think, I hope it will be successful and interesting and people will start to see the benefits of PCs for living room gaming as opposed to just consoles.
That would be nice.
Yeah.
Crysis 3 system requirements revealed. Can your PC run Crysis? Okay, so for people who are not familiar with Crysis, for a considerably Crysis, the original version of Crysis was like the mother of all hell experiences for GPUs. If you wanted to just beat the snot out of a GPU, you fired up Crysis, you fired up the maximum settings, and you listened to GPUs weep. And when Crysis 2 came out, one of the big questions was, is this a video game I want to play, or is this a video game that's going to be used in every video card review for the next 3 years because of what it, the sort of death and destruction and mayhem and suffering and overheating and everything else bad in the world of a GPU that this game or this engine generates. So I got to ask, Tim Berry writing this up at PC Per, what are you going to need to run this game, and what are you going to need to run this game well, and is it going to be another torture test for innocent GPUs?
It kind of looks like it. I personally hope so. We had this discussion when we were playing Far Cry 3, which is also a very demanding game. Not as demanding as this looks like it's going to be. But the idea, long story short, some people were saying that it's, what good is it to release a game that a lot of people can't play, you know, in its best mode? And I say you've got to have this back and forth between hardware and software developers to move the entire industry and the entire medium forward. And Crysis did that. Say what you want about the game itself. Maybe it wasn't that great, but it definitely made GPU vendors strive to put out higher performance parts, which then left all the other developers all this extra headroom to play with and create new games. So the recommended system requirements that they're going with are DirectX 11 GPU with a gig of memory. Not that dramatic, actually. Quad-core processor, and they're even listing pre-Sandy Bridge parts as the processor, Core i3 5530 and a Phenom 2. And then for the GPU, GTX 560 or AMD 5870. Those are pretty modestly spec'd out parts today. But if you look at the high performance settings, and this is what you would need in theory to enable the higher image quality settings in the game, you're looking at the top end parts from both vendors, GTX 680 or an HD 7970, and then a top end Sandy Bridge processor and 8 gigs of memory, right? So hard to say for sure. It's possible that the high performance listing that they have here is just like, well, this is the best of everything that's out there, so we'll just say it's that. Whether or not you actually need it, or if you know, there's room for it to scale ahead of that, like if you have a 690 or two 680s or two 7970s or whatever it is, right? So, but I'm looking forward to it. It's actually, I think they announced the release dates today, mid to late February in North America, so it will be that title again. I have a feeling.
I would not be surprised. Intel might become a foundry for ARM if Apple goes x86. Scott Michaud of PC Per says, hopefully they don't make your head hurt too much with that title. Intel announced early in the year the opening of their fabrication labs to certain other developers, none of which competing with anything Intel does. We joked about how this is the end of the world as we know it, although we feel fine. As it turns out, the world might end December 12. RBC rumors that Intel might fulfill orders of ARM processors, taking away that responsibility from Samsung. So the catch is that it is possible that Intel will allow Apple to manufacture their ARM-based processors at Intel if Apple switches their tablets to x86-based products. So I'm not holding my breath on that one.
Right. So this the validity of this rumor is that it came from, you know, not some Taiwanese tech-based website or something like that. It came from RBC. But people were trying to figure out, well, why would Intel suddenly give up that one advantage? They're not hurting for money. They're not looking to find a new revenue source necessarily by, like, taking foundry business away from Samsung. So what would the benefit be for them? And it would be maybe if they could trade off. We'll give Apple a huge discount on this if they happen to use some x86 parts in other products. Maybe it's just that maybe Apple's thinking, hey, you know what? We're really thinking about moving to ARM for our MacBook Airs or something like that, right? And Intel's like, oh, whoa, okay, that could be a big problem. Maybe now we'll open up that foundry and give them a discount just so they'll stay with us. So there's a couple different angles you could look at it in terms of why Intel would suddenly be willing to give up its crown jewel in the technology world, which is its foundry business.
While we're talking about Apple and Intel, we should probably talk about something that just got posted. Well, I guess it probably posted up this morning, but I've still been marveling about it. Apple CEO Tim Cook announced plans to manufacture Mac computers in the United States, something I really wasn't expecting, despite the fact Apple's come under a lot of flack for their manufacturing operations overseas in the last year or two. But rockcenter.nbcnews.com, Apple CEO Tim Cook revealed that one of the existing Mac lines will be manufactured exclusively in the United States next year, making the comments during an exclusive interview with Brian Williams airing tonight at 10 p.m. 9 Central on NBC's Rock Center. Mac fans will have to wait to see which Mac line it will be because Apple, widely known for its secrecy, left it vague, writes Ronnie Polidoro for Rock Center. But yeah, Cook says they've been working for years doing more and more in the United States. And apparently some iMacs have been inscribed on the back with assembled in the USA, which has had people talking on the internets. Interesting stuff. Also, I thought it was interesting that Cook told Rock Center, quote, when you back up and look at Apple's effect on job creation in the United States, we estimate that we've created more than 600,000 jobs now, which apparently vary from research and development jobs in Cali to retail store hires to third-party app developers. And that, I think that last one.
That's a big stretch, isn't it?
That's well, you know, no iOS platform, no iOS apps. But yeah, that's... You know what? Hey,
but I think Microsoft should put out a stat on how many jobs they've created over the last 20 years. Yeah.
That would be pretty funny. So, you know, this is exciting. I like the idea of I like the idea of bringing them over here. So,
yep.
Interesting update. AMD and Intel. One of the things we were talking about last week was that apparently everybody wants to solder chips onto the motherboard, eliminate the sockets, eliminate upgradability, pretty much eliminate choice in motherboard manufacturing and CPU choice. And this week, apparently, the story is completely different. Or I should say AMD has gone, no, you misunderstood us.
Well, since last week, right. Intel was the only one that was threatening this, right? Okay. And they weren't really – let me rephrase that. They weren't threatening it. There was rumors that Intel was going to do that after this pending Broadwell architecture, right? It was always just rumors. But what happened this week was both AMD and Intel kind of came out with their own responses. AMD came out with a response a little bit earlier that said basically we're not going to do that. Regardless of whether or not it's true that Intel is going to do that, we are promising we're not going to do that. They said we have no plans at this time to move to BGA-only packaging and look forward to continuing to support this critical segment of the market. For the desktop market enthusiasts with whom AMD has built its brand, we understand what matters to them and how we can continue to bring better value and a better experience. So their response was basically like, hey, look, guys, regardless of what Intel is doing, they're saying that they're not going to give up on the idea of a DIY PC. And it makes sense for them to say that because they're looking for any positive spin they can get out of their CPU business right now. Any positive press they can get, any positive feeling they can get from the community and the industry as a whole, right? So, because I think we posited at the end of last week's show that was like, well, if Intel does that, maybe more people will go to AMD. And AMD is obviously hoping that will be the case, maybe. And they also kind of put out the statement, I think, to say in a somewhat way, hey, if you want to support a company that is promising to support the enthusiasts, maybe right. you should buy our parts now so that we're still around in 2015 and 2016 and that kind of stuff to make these parts and fulfill these promises and that kind of stuff. They didn't actually say that. That's just kind of what
right. implied.
Yeah.
You like kind of building your own PC? Maybe you should buy an AMD bulldozer now so you can buy an AMD super carrier in a couple of years when Intel's only selling you crap that's soldered onto the Intel motherboard, eliminating choice in the marketplace. Right.
But meanwhile, Intel also put out their own statement that said almost the same type of thing with a little bit different language. They just basically said Intel remains committed to the desktop enthusiasts and channel markets and will continue to offer socketed parts in the LGA package for the foreseeable future for our customers in the enthusiast DIY market. However, Intel cannot comment on specific long-term product roadmap plans at this time. So theirs was maybe a little bit more cagey, but kind of saying the same thing. Hey, we're still going to make socketed processors. So it's possible that this is kind of all overblown. It's likely, actually. But I think...
Well, you were fearing for the life and well-being of your business. I mean, there's
well, yeah, but I mean, because my business is directly tied to the enthusiast market, right? If the enthusiast market were to, in some dream world, completely vanish, it would be a big problem. And I don't think it's unreasonable to think, though, that it will continue to shrink and shrink and shrink, and that things like the BGA packaging that Intel's thinking about is possible. One of the emails we have a little bit later kind of gets into that too. But I just thought it was important to point out that both of these companies kind of had responses to all those stories and rumors going around.
I thought there was a story that really caught my eye. I wanted to cover it before we go. I'll do it really fast. The FCC, this is the executive summary. The FCC tells the FAA, let folks use cell phones on airplanes, which is not entirely true. The FCC told the FAA to allow greater use of electronic devices during flights, written up by Jennifer Martinez over at Silicon Valley. And basically, the FCC has launched a study group this summer to look at policies and guidance on in-air use of electronic devices, because everybody wants to use their tablets and their computers and their phones constantly before they take off, after they land, every time in between. The chairman of the FCC, Julius Genachowski, called on the Federal Aviation Administration to, quote, enable greater use of tablets, e-readers, and other portable devices during flights in a letter sent Thursday to Michael Huerta, the acting administrator of the FAA. And we should point out that as early as 2004, apparently, the FCC considered lifting rules that prohibited in-flight use of cell phones and other wireless devices. But they basically gave up on that because they couldn't get information they felt was solid. Quote, the FAA said the study would not consider allowing voice communications during flight. That was, I should say, the FAA had a study group this summer. The FCC is telling the FAA to lighten up, I think. I'm kind of torn because on one hand, I would love to be able to make phone calls during flights. And on the other hand, I could think of no hell fresher than the idea of being trapped next to that guy having that call on his phone next to me and yelling at somebody or having an aggro conversation.
Yeah,
a 4-hour flight in this country. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I thought the idea that the FCC has gotten so bored they want to tell the FAA to let us use our phones is pretty funny. So Twitch, TWICH at twit.tv. That's the email address. We love your questions. We're going to answer a few of those in just a moment. And if you're not familiar with Twitch, maybe you're hanging out with a friend. Maybe you stumbled across us on the great wide expanses of the interwebs. If you want to find us or find more Twitch episodes, that's TWICH, by the way. It's twit.tv/Twitch, or search inside of your favorite podcatcher.
Do we have our friends from?
We do.
We do.
We have friends. We have friends, nice. Patrick. We have friends, and these particular friends come from Lantronics. XPrint Media Server. I'm sorry, XPrint Server is the particular device there. So we've talked about them a couple times before. We wanted to mention them again. They have a whole new deal for us too. Go ahead.
Oh, no, no, no. I was just going to say, if you haven't heard of the XPrint server, so Lantronics makes a box that allows you to print to pretty much any printer from your iOS device. You might say, but I can already use AirPrint. And you can if you have an HP printer, which I personally refuse to buy. Nothing against HP printers. I'm an Epson kind of guy. And in theory, there are some applications that allow you to print from inside this. But this is the idea that this is wireless printing for your iPads, your iPhones, using the native print menu built inside of there, which is cool. So no printing through apps, no software to install, no stupid emailing yourself to documents to make them print, which I just incredibly just, I obviously I find that annoying. And what's interesting is the XPrint server supports something like 4,000 USB and network printers, which is a pretty long list of printers.
Yeah, it is. So, my favorite part of it, though, is just how easy it is to like set up and use. I think their slogan is, or with the bullet point they give us here is like, just open it, plug it in, and print. And usually you see that on a box, and it's, okay, maybe that's accurate. But on this, it actually truly is. I remember they sent me one, and I opened it up, literally, and I was like, I have no idea what this does. And it says, open it, plug it in, and print. So I opened it. You plug in a network cable to your router. You plug in a power cable. You wait until the light stops flashing, which takes about 30 seconds as it kind of detects all the printers on your network. If you have networked printers, which we did. And then we took out an iPhone and printed an email. And it recognized our printer right away. And it was literally probably the easiest technological device, you know, I've ever had to set up. It's essentially like plugging in a mouse into a USB port. When all of a sudden plug and play started working in Windows 95, 98 timeframe, you're like, wow, this is going to revolutionize everything. It had the same effect of, could have been an incredibly complicated process where I had to go to a web panel and I had to log in and I had to tell my printer and I had to maybe like upload a driver file or something like that. Nope, it all did all that for it. Automatically, which is really, really cool. And it's only, the home edition's $99, which is really nice. If you have a whole lot of network printers, the home edition supports 8 USB printers and 2 network printers. The network edition is $150 and supports unlimited network printers. So it's obviously good for your home office, or even a pretty big size office, right? As a side benefit, it has a USB port on it. And when you plug a printer into that USB port, it basically becomes a network shared printer automatically. So any other computer, not just your iPhone or iOS device, but any other computer on that network will then be able to see it and print to that printer, which is pretty nice.
I mean, this is pretty awesome. It's anybody who comes in your house with an iPhone will be able to print to your printer if you give them permission. I mean, it's pretty slick, ladies and gentlemen.
Yep. All you have to do... Where we're going to point you to get information on this is xprintserver.com/twit, xprintserver.com/twit for more information and to learn how to buy and that kind of stuff. And it's the holidays. It's time for a special offer. If you use coupon HOLIDAY2012, all one word, HOLIDAY2012, you get 20% off of your order. So xprintserver.com/twit, offer code HOLIDAY2012. And you'll get 20% off one of those. So that $100 can go down to $80 if my math works out correctly. And it's if you have a lot of iOS devices in your house, if you and your girlfriend or you and your wife and your two kids all have iOS devices, you know, iPod Touch, all that kind of stuff will all function with one of these, and they'll be able to print things and use your iOS devices in maybe ways that you didn't think you'd be able to use them to.
There you have it. We want to thank Lantronics for sponsoring the show. We want to thank them for their support. We hope you check out the offer. It's a pretty good one. Yep. Fire up some email questions. We've got a couple minutes left in the show. Scott wanted to give us an update about his Hackintosh build. He says, hey, guys, I wrote a few weeks ago about switching to Windows after 15 years as a Mac user, and you guys suggested that I build a Hackintosh. Thank you very much for taking the time to help me out. I ended up going both routes. I built my rig using components from Tony Mac X86, and I am now running Windows 8 and OS 10 Lion. See the pics. As you suggested, I used the Twit know-how video to help with Unibeast, and it could not have been easier. Not including the time it took to download Lion start to finish for the OS install was under 45 minutes. Awesome.
Yep.
So he's running a Core i7-3770K with a Corsair Hydro 860 water cooler, EVGA GeForce GTX 660 Ti, FTW plus 3 gigabytes, gigabyte GA Z77X UD5H Mobo, 32 gigs of G-Skills Sniper RAM, a 256 gigabyte Vertex 4, 2 2-terabyte Caviar Blacks for his photos, a Seasonic 750-watt X750 Gold PSU, Asus PB278Q 27-inch IPS monitor running at 2560 by 1440. Wow. I'm officially beyond jealous at this point.
Yeah.
Bottom line, he says, I couldn't be happier with my new toy. My first computer build went off without a scratch, and I thank you guys for your help.
That's what we love to hear. Yeah, I mean, that's, first of all, yeah, like Patrick said, killer system,
yeah.
Top of the line parts there, nice 2560 by 1440 display, and he's running Mac OS X and Windows 8. So that's,
there you have it.
It's good. Good stuff.
It's awesome, dude. We are excited to have been able to help you. Jason has a question about the Intel socket issue. He says, hi, Ryan and Patrick. In the last episode, I heard you guys talking about the issues of stocking Intel CPUs and motherboards, since you would need like 5 different models of each motherboard for the different CPU combinations. But what if Intel finally took full advantage of the unclocking unlocking technology they have already been testing, where you have a single CPU and you unlock features using software? They could easily include a dual-core CPU and allow you to unlock quad-core, more speed, and or hyper-threading. So MCI just has one physical motherboard CPU, and then you pay a little extra after you build the system if you want it to run faster.
So this is kind of after last week we talked about BGA processors and the motherboard companies having to deal with all that. So I just put this email in here because I thought it was probably a while ago, a year, maybe 2 years ago. Remember when Intel had a very small run of systems that they would sell, and then you could buy like the gift card type things at the front of the register to like unlock hyper threading or unlock extra cache on your processor, right? So he's basically saying that they could do the exact same thing with this, where, you know, they give a chip to Asus or MSI or whoever, right? And it's, you know, out of the box, it's a dual core Core i3 3000, you know, 3350 or whatever it is, with no integrated graphics. But if you go to intel.com and you get this key code, you can unlock the HD 4000 graphics. And then you pay a little bit more and you can unlock hyper-threading. You pay a little bit more. Oh, it's actually a quad-core part with hyper-threading. And I just thought, that sounds like a hell that I don't want to live in, right? It's actually, it's interesting both ways. The fact that you could upgrade instantly whatever you want without having to worry about swapping parts and all that kind of stuff sounds really cool, until maybe you think about, I have all this potential inside my computer that's not being utilized.
I gotta say, if it gets to the point where chips are soldered in the motherboard, and it's kind of funny, because right now, if you're not video editing or audio editing or doing some pretty serious content creation or some pretty serious gaming or some really serious like ripping multiple Blu-rays simultaneously, you just don't saturate the power available in a Core i5, much less a Core i7. You know what I mean? Or a Core i3. I mean, it takes a lot of computing to actually really put a hurt on one of these chips. Fire up the right video game, start doing video editing, wham, you just kick the chip right in the teeth. So, and on one sense, I could think at some point, you know, Intel's capacity is going to be so high, and I have this funny vision of like, man, Intel, like, we produce all the chips and you know, we have no bad chips and the yields are amazing and screw it. Let's just make the super expensive chip, and, you know, they'll put some silicon on the silicon that allows them to lock it out. Certainly, I believe that's possible. Certainly, I believe Intel, it might actually be a really smart thing for Intel to do. It would just be, I don't know, there's some part of me, you know, maybe that would be awesome if I could buy the same part for $100 or $400 and get the $100 performance or the $400 performance, but it's,
you know,
weird.
The, it makes, it, it's weird. It leaves a dirty taste in your mouth. It just kind of feels scummy. But the real secret is the real secret is they already do this.
Right.
So, I mean, when you buy a 3570K that doesn't have hyper-threading enabled, that's just a choice, right? There's no technical difference why that could have it. They just made that decision and sold it to you for a little bit less. Same thing when you have a dual core. Chances are that the other two cores are on there and that they'll operate just fine, but they made a choice and they sell it to you for a little bit less. So the yields issue is the real question for them is, would they even be able to do this? So I don't know. It's interesting to see.
You're not waiting with bated breath. We got time for one more question before we go. Sure. Should we talk about a unique monitor resolution or some low cost motherboard options?
Let's go with low-cost motherboard options.
Gabriel says, I'm currently getting ready to build a serious video editing rig that will hopefully last me a few years. Fingers crossed, based on the Core i7-3770K. I want to keep the cost down mainly so I can get a Cat Leap 27-inch monitor as well. Yes, go Cat Leap. I used PCPartPicker.com to build a system. I heard about it on Twitch a while back, and it came out around $1,500, which is just about the top end of my budget. One of the most expensive parts of the build is the motherboard, with the Asus Sabertooth Z77 ATX LGA 1155 motherboard coming in at $230. I was wondering if there is a good sub-$200 or even sub-$150 replacement that would work well instead. I'm looking for a board that supports at least 32 gigs of RAM that will allow potential upgrades in the future. Thunderbolt on board would be nice, but I've been having trouble finding Thunderbolt motherboards for less than $250 or $230. He gives us a parts list. He talks about the Intel 330 180 gigabyte solid state drive he got for $89.99 after a $30 rebate. He says, I feel like I found a steal. And yes, that is an awesome steal.
Pretty good.
He says, thank you for helping me stay informed with the latest hardware information on a weekly basis. Gabriel, thank you so much for listening. And you have choices, several choices, in fact.
So the first one is you're not going to be able to find... The first one I linked to was an Asus P8 Z77 V Pro Thunderbolt, and it's a $239 Thunderbolt based motherboard. But if we look at there's an MSI one we have over here. It's the G40. Uh-huh. No, what is it? Z77 A G. Now I'm missing it. There's one. The MSI has a Thunderbolt-based motherboard that is under $180. There it is, $159. Z77A G45 Thunderbolt is $159 on Newegg. And it is a Z77 board. It's got Thunderbolt. It's actually a really, really good board. It's a good overclocking, too. It doesn't sound like he's going to do that since he wants to be, you know, have no stability issues with his build. Asus does not have a Thunderbolt motherboard under that $230 price range. They do have motherboards. Like, you can get a Z77 motherboard. I think it's the Z77 VLX for like $129. But you are starting to lose some things. You're going to have fewer PCI Express slots that are replaced by PCI slots. You don't get the capability to run certain versions of the RAID software, right? So you can't run RAID 5 and that kind of stuff, which you may want to do, especially on a video editing rig where, you know, you want some performance and you want some data reliability and that kind of stuff as well. So keep in mind of what features you lose as you go down to these lower price parts. But if you are really keen on Thunderbolt and you're wanting to get a part that is low cost, $160, you know, so you're going to save $70 essentially over your current build by going with the Z77A G45 Thunderbolt. And it supports Crossfire SLI, THX, you know, all that kind of stuff. 32 gigs of memory like he was requesting. And it has 3 full-size PCI Express by 16 slots too.
You know what? That could be another 16 gigabytes of memory, a small hard drive.
Yeah. For $70. Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, we hope you enjoyed this episode of Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. Twitch at twit.tv is the email address if you've got a question for us or a comment, a suggestion, or a deal you want to let us know of. It's been an exciting week on Techzilla. We actually shot December 27th episode this morning. So I know what the top tips of 2012 were. and 5 tweaks you should make to your new HDTV, your home theater equipment when you get it home. But we talked about actually, we had a really great question. And someone in the audience actually is roasting me right now on Twitter. Because he says on Techzilla, I mistook the AMD Phenom for the AMD 64X2. And let me put this into context. We have a viewer who just bought Premiere Pro CS6 and wants to edit on it. Was like, should I get a new GPU or should I get a new CPU? And I'm like, you need CPU and a memory because you're running like a 4-year-old processor with 2 gigabytes of RAM. So that was my response to this guy on Twitter. I was like, I'm sorry. I forget about 4-year-old processors.
Yeah, I wouldn't, that's fine. I don't have that kind of memory either. So once we're past 24 months, that's old school to me.
It's great that it's still running, sir. Please add more memory to that system before you try to run Premiere. Yeah, we've got actually, go to youtube.com/techhd. We've got buyer's guides for cell phones with Sasha Sagan from PC Mag, Lori Grunin from CNET, who is a camera maven, gives us some really great from affordable to out of control and some inexpensive accessories you can pick up for the photo buff in your life. I also got to say, Photo Jojo, if you want crazy lenses for your cell phone camera, Photo Jojo is a great resource. They are really, really fun. I want to thank them for... being on Techzilla. And with that bright and cheerful note, we should probably bid adieu to the beautiful people that are listening to Twitch and watching Twitch right now. This week in computer hardware, twit.tv/Twitch, or email us twitch@twit.tv. There's a lot of T's in there and the braces are killing me. That's it for this episode of Twitch. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Schrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.
What day is it? It's Thursday, isn't it? It's always Thursday when we do this. Okay. What day is it? So old.
Get off my lawn.
Did I mention I've made a lot of television and stuff today?
Oh. Have I mentioned that, like, for the last 3 days, I keep attempting to make television and words, and instead everybody has those days where you leave the office, and you go, damn it, I didn't do anything today, but you just never stopped not doing anything all day. I hate that feeling. It's the worst.
Yeah, I hear you, dude. I just spent 12 hours in the office. I did all of this stuff. I had 2 things on my to-do list for the day.
Right.
I haven't started either one of them.
And all I did was add 5 things to the to-do list. Like, that's what I did instead. Actually, I literally have been here for 12 hours, and I feel like that's a pretty close summation of how it's been.
I'm sorry, dude. It's like you have children, but you have a business instead.
Yeah.
Wait till you have children, Ryan. It just gets better.
I have a very loving and patient dog that will just sit at my feet no matter what I'm doing. So she
I love dogs. I love my dog.
she's not a lot of trouble to take care of.